Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Juan Valdez doing business as JV Construction Company versus Diamond Shamrock Refining and Marketing Company and Diamond Shamrock Stations Incorporated from Denton County, and Eli Lilly and Company and Dista Products Company, a division of Eli Lilly, versus the Honorable John Marshall, an original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court will allow 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relators may reserve a certain portion of that time for rebuttal argument. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these causes. These arguments are being recorded on tape for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, please make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Valdez versus Diamond Shamrock.
May it please the court, Mr. Willis Kuhn and Mr. Mark Ferguson to present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Kuhn, will.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Bill Kuhn. I'm from Dallas, Texas, representing the petitioner, Mr. Juan Valdez. As you know, this case involves the issue of a mechanics lien and whether it attached to a point-acre corner tract that was carved off, replatted, and sold to respondent after construction had commenced on the property. I believe that the single most important point of error is number 6, which deals with the question of when did Mr. Valdez's lien have its inception and when did it attach to whatever property he was entitled to lien protection. The relation back doctrine, codified in section 53.124, says that it relates back in time and commences or attaches on the date that visible construction first began. This court in Diversified Mortgage versus Blaylock said that it is an after-acquired title question as well, and that it attaches to the equitable or legal interest of the contracting party at the time work was begun, and thereafter to any other or greater interest whenever acquired before the lien is enforced. At the time Mr. Valdez began his work in February of 1986, there was but a single city lot on which he was doing work. It was also a single undivided tract.
7.9 acres.
Excuse me, Your Honor, yes, 7.9 acres.
What if it had been 700 acres?
I don't know that there would be any city lot of that size.
But not many of them that are 7.9.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that if we're talking with a statutory lien as opposed to the constitutional lien where you get into the issue of what's necessary, I think it would attach to all of the acreage, and I think that the owner, if he's building the guard kiosk, for example, that was referenced in Respondent 3, as Lyon noted, has the power and ability to limit the exposure of the land to less than the 700 acres in your example. I think the burden is on the owner if he has Mr. Juan Valdez put in a small parking lot, for example, to put in there that it's limited, his scope of work is limited to a certain area.
So no matter what the size of the lot is, your view of the statute in question here is that if it's one lot as platted in the records of the city, and the construction, even if it be over on a little corner of the property, nevertheless, there may be a lien against the entire tract.
There could be, and I would say that that my reading of the cases says that we are dealing with an issue of what is reasonable notice under a specific set of facts. And to me, there's a vast difference between taking 90% of this particular tract and doing vast pouring and construction, which arguably benefited everything, and then carving off a small piece at the end. What kind of notice that gave Mr. Valdez, as to your example, wherein someone comes in and builds a guard kiosk, maybe there is no restriction, but 700 acres is laying out there. I think that the question of who's getting deceived and where the harm falls might well be a different case. I would say that the only case that I've read where a lien was restricted to less than a city lot, if we're talking about whatever acreage, was the Yates case, in which that lady had a homestead right, had a separate property right, and I think it was a stretch by the court to give the contractor claimant any kind of a lien at all.
In this case, Diamond Shamrock asserted they did not have any notice, either constructive or actual notice, of any claim made by Mr. Valdez from that .8 tribe.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that...
how do you dispute that?
The affidavits of the broker, who is an agent for Diamond Shamrock under the law, and the agent who admits in his affidavit he's an agent acting for Diamond Shamrock, Landman, I think his name was Jerry Compton, both say that they were familiar with the project as early as the spring of 1985, which was well before any construction was done, and that they visited the site, quote, on a daily basis. Now, these are real estate people. They could have easily checked the deed records and would have seen that the construction loan and the deed of trust recorded under Opus One Limited that was financing Mr. Valdez's work, for example, covered all of the 7.9 acres. But my argument is, even if they didn't bother to look at anything in any deed record, it is unreasonable to walk onto a site, a tract of land that's 8 acres, on which there's cement being poured on 90% of it, and say that they have no constructive notice that there might be potential lien claimants. And it's a very myopic view, in my opinion, to walk over to a small little corner and say, there's nothing specifically on this little part, and therefore I have no notice. If they were going to do that, at least they should have gone to the deed records and confirmed that, yes, that is a separate, replatted, distinct lot. If they'd have done that, they'd have seen, no, it wasn't. I think in the deed they took, the easements, the recitals should have put them on notice that this was replatted as of May. They took their deed in July of 86. The documents relating to their title showed and should have put them on notice that this property was replatted in May. If they had the on-site notice that their affidavits say, and therefore knew that construction had been going on for months and months and months, that should have given them a red light that they should either have demanded lien releases from all the people out there, or they should have withheld some of the purchase price for this very narrow window. And I think that this case involves a direct issue of public policy. We are talking about balancing where the burden should fall when a problem like this arises. On the one hand,
53.022C again, and the property code, that section that we parties are focused on.
Yes, sir.
Is your view that lot means lot, no matter how big, or that there might be circumstances where you had to look at something else?
I think lot means lot, no matter how big, unless there are specific circumstances in a case where the court can clearly say a given subcontractor was on notice, whether it be a limitation. For example, an example is if in Juan Valdez's contract they would have said this project is specifically limited to 7.1 acres. Or if the record showed that this was fenced off and a sign was out there that said this part is for sale, then I would argue there is a lot less risk of misleading the given subcontractor. But other than that, I think you read the statute on its face that the legislature had meant it to be that the lien will attach to the building and that part of a lot reasonably necessary thereto. Had engrafted the constitutional lien question, they could have written it that way, but it says each lot on which a building sits. The issue here before the court.
What was the date of filing of the actual mechanics lien?
September 16th, I believe, of 86.
And by that time, Diamond Shamrock had purchased the property and
taken
their deed.
Yes, sir.
How much money is involved here?
Excluding interest and attorney's fees, the trial court fixed the original lien at $91,000. Dollars and some change, and the project was about $1.3 million. Valdez's part was $1.3 million. I think they Opus One borrowed, I think, $2.4 million, if record serves me correctly.
Is Opus One solved?
No, Opus One
belly up?
Is belly up. The contractor, Ambassador One, is insolvent. The 7.1 acres was foreclosed by the first mortgage lien holder. So this is the last piece of property from which Mr. Valdez can get any source of funds. But getting back to the question of that permeates this entire field, who's entitled to notice and where the lien attaches, when, if the burden is going to be on the owner can protect itself. The Lyon Court, which is this court, which was subsequently discussed very well by the Fifth Circuit in the Waller Creek case, says that the issue is, number one, to remember that the scope of the lien is a matter that is within control of the property owner, and number two, that the contractor should be protected from being deceived as to the value of the property on which his lien will attach.
Regards deception, however, at the time Diamond Shamrock bought their piece, they had no actual or constructive notice that there was any land claimed on their property, on that piece.
That was not a piece, and I can't agree to that argument. I think they were on, they had actual notice that the reality, which was a 7.9-acre tract, had massive visible construction.
There were no other land claims at that time.
No other land claims were ever filed.
And they didn't receive notice until 3.5 years later. What accounts for that delay?
Mr. Valdez did not search the deed records and was not aware, according to the affidavit from the transcript, was not aware that there was a conveyance of that piece of property until well after the lawsuit had been tried, the first lawsuit had been tried to completion. The issue here is one of the burden. The bankruptcy court up in Dallas in the In Re Musa case addresses this. Who are you going to put the burden on to prevent harm? We're talking about an issue of liberal construction to protect the laborer. If Mr. Valdez has the burden, then that means for every big project, he goes in on the last day, or his lawyer goes in on the last day, and there may be, instead of one, there may be 6 or 8 or 10 deeds from the developer. Sometimes there's going to be complex property descriptions involved. How is he supposed to guess which owner? How is he supposed to protect himself, reasonably protect himself, when it's so easy for the owner or the new owner to either put it in the contract as a limitation, get releases from the liens, from the lien releases from the subcontractors, or, as they should have done in this case, simply wait. They waited the 60 days or 90 days before beginning construction.
And that's a hard case. But in this case, not only was it not very difficult for Mr. Valdez to find out, he ultimately did.
He ultimately did, but I think it is better public policy to ask Diamond Shamrock to make a contract to buy this land that would have protected itself. Its title company could have reported back on September 17th before any construction of any major nature should have gone on. Hey, there's a lien affidavit that's been filed against Opus One. It may impact our property. Let's get this resolved. I think the burden is better there than asking a subcontractor to basically do title searches.
What is the best argument that you have not made, if you have one, that perhaps if Mr. Valdez had any rights, he slept on his rights from a lack of supplies by waiting 3+ years to assert this claim?
Well, number one, I disagree that latches is available to these parties because they didn't act prudently in how they handled their transaction. Buying the land, knowing should have known it was sub replatted, construction's out there, there's no limit in the contract. Valdez's delay, number one, has to be unreasonable. And to the extent he's dealing with the owner or reputed owner, he's filed a lawsuit and they don't raise any issue about there being a defect of parties. And the fact that we are within the statutory, I think latches very seldom should apply when a party asserts his claim within his statutory limitation period. I would reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Mark Ferguson. I'm here on behalf of the American Subcontractors Association with Mr. Kuhn. You may ask yourself, why are the subcontractors here? Why have they brought forward their claims? Well, it's simple. Right now, they already have to look to first the financial solvency of the general contractor, the upper tier contractor. Next, they have to look to the financial solvency of the owner. As the 80s have proved, that's not a very good feeling. Now they look to the property as the Constitution and statute allows them. By allowing this decision to hold, we allow landowners to sever out the most important, valuable pieces of the property and leave the subcontractors out in the cold. And yes, I represent there are several subcontractors here today. The owner and the subsequent purchaser are in the best position to protect themselves, not the subcontractor. The subcontractor has an inception date. He looks to the title on that inception date. He is not versed in meets and bounds and properties descriptions. He acquires these at the inception date, pays $25 from the title company, and now he knows where to secure his debt. Further, his time to give notice is limited. And I think this goes to Justice Hecht and Justice Gonzalez's, why did they wait 3.5 years? Well, when that lien is filed, they sit on it. They have a time period in which to bring suit to foreclose on the lien. Quite often these things are settled, the money pops up somewhere. Or the lender takes the property back and there's nobody to sue to foreclose on the lien. 3.5 years go by because nobody, to my knowledge, will go daily review those property records to see if the property's been flipped because they have an inception date. And all the subcontractor liens relate back to that date.
Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Larry Bracken will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. No matter how draconian or complicated petitioner and amicus want to make this case, it really boils down to one issue, Your Honor, and that issue is this. Is it going to be the policy of this state that an owner of record title at the time a mechanic's lien affidavit is filed is to be notified that a lien claim is being asserted against his property? That is the primary issue. A secondary issue, if that issue is answered one way or the other, as to what property does a mechanic's lien extend. The facts to come to grips with these two issues are really simple. Diamond Shamrock recorded its lien in August of 1986.
It's deed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Deed.
It's deed. I'm sorry. Yes, sir, Your Honor. Mr. Valdez filed his lien affidavit in September of 1986. From the time Diamond Shamrock's predecessor in interest, Opus, acquired this property, this 7.9-acre tract. This 0.8-acre tract up in the northwest corner, which was eventually conveyed to Diamond Shamrock, was always treated separately.
By whom?
By the owner, Opus.
Were there, was it fenced?
No, sir, it wasn't fenced, Your Honor.
Well, just looking at it, what indicated that it was treated separate and apart from the rest of the...
By the very simple fact, Your Honor, we're not talking about a small piece of property. We're talking about 8/10 of an acre, in excess of 35,000 square feet. Mr. Valdez worked all around the edge of this property and never built one improvement or delivered any materials to this 8/10 of an acre tract.
That's not my question. My question is, what indicia of separateness is out there that anybody could see?
If they talk about looking in the deed records, Your Honor, in the construction loan, this 8-acre tract was set aside as a release tract. That was in the deed records. In addition,
that's in the record of this case?
Yes, sir, it is. It is, Your Honor. In addition, we're dealing with the statute as the statute was worded in 1986 and not as the statute is worded today. The notice we're dealing with is two types in this case. The first notice is a pre-lien notice as codified in Chapter 53.056. This is the notice that a lien claimant must give periodically. At the time the statute, that 1986 statute required the notice to be given by the 10th day of each month, 90 days after the work was completed for each month it was completed. The purpose of this notice is to require or to allow the owner to retain funds from his general contractor to pay to a subcontractor. In all candor with this court, except for the fact that Mr. Valdez is attempting to subject Diamond Shamrock's property to a lien, and the code and statute at that time required notice to the owner, The purpose behind giving this notice is totally absent with respect to Diamond Shamrock. And that is because this property, this 8.8-acre tract, was always treated separately. There were no improvements on it. When Diamond Shamrock purchased it, it was barren. There was not a general contractor that Diamond Shamrock had a relationship with to retain any funds for. There was no improvement for Mr. Valdez, a mechanic's lien to attach to.
How about the affidavit? How do you respond to the prior argument you heard that the affidavit of this Jerry Compton clearly shows that from day one, you know, this broker knew of the activity on all of the tracks and therefore had an obligation or duty to notify prospective purchasers about any lien claimants out there?
Your Honor, I would respond to that in several ways. First, we're talking about actual notice here. The actual notice from the build, from the construction activity that Mr. Valdez was doing on the remaining 7.1 acres. Mr. Valdez is a subcontractor. A subcontractor cannot have a lien based upon actual knowledge. He cannot have it based upon his improvements. He must follow the statutory requirements. And besides, this tract had always been treated separately. There was not any improvement at all on this tract.
You keep saying it treated separately, but I see something. But for the argument that you said this was a release tract, I haven't heard you say anything as high was treated separately.
But the only other way it was treated separately, Your Honor, is that there was nothing done on this tract. It was always vacant and unimproved. No one did any improvements to it. Work went on around it, but other than that, there is nothing. He's right. There was no Berlin Wall built around this tract. But the cases don't require that. Over 100 years of case law, starting with the Lyon v. Logan case, the Guarantee Savings v. Cash case, the Strain v. Frey case, all Texas Supreme Court cases say that the property, that the owner can protect a certain piece of property by always treating it separately. And he can do this through contract. Mr. Valdez's contract, first off, did not name the owner, and second off, did not describe the property to which his work would extend. There is nothing in these cases that say that there must be two separate contracts to protect this property. In fact, both the Lyon case and the Guarantee Savings case, as indicated by the Houston Electrical Distributing case versus MMB Enterprises, say that what's important is that two contracts are required only if materials are actually delivered to both these tracks. And in this case, no material was delivered to Diamond Shamrock's track.
When did Diamond Shamrock start negotiating with Opus to purchase this property?
In the fall of 1985, Your Honor.
Fall of 85.
Yes, sir. They started negotiating, I'm not sure whether it was over with Opus, but they started negotiating with the representative from Saban Huey, the realtors.
And when did construction actually begin? When did Mr. Valdez begin his work?
As best I recall, in February of 86, Your Honor.
And were those negotiations ongoing between December of 85 until the deed was consummated and exchanged? The summer of 86.
I'm not sure of the detail of as far as the actual transactions were going on. One thing that was going on is the actual replatting of this tract of property, which started in December of 1985. That was ongoing, Your Honor. I'm not sure as to the actual negotiation. I'm not sure whether they were completed before February or after February.
The petitioner argues that it's very difficult for a subcontractor to know who the owner developer may be flipping property to before the end of construction. What's your response to that?
First off, Your Honor, there was not a flip involved in this case. There was not a flip involved towards the end of construction. This was all done back in November of 1985. But aside from that, my response to that is this, that a subcontractor and a purchaser such as Diamond Shamrock are really in the same boat. A subcontractor, from the sense that he doesn't have a direct contractual relationship with the owner. So to find out who the owner is, he must rely on someone else. That someone else is either the owner at the time of his contract or the general contractor. A purchaser such as Diamond Shamrock is in the same situation, especially in this case where the subcontractor doesn't file either his contract or a memorandum of his contract. The only way that Diamond Shamrock would know about subcontractors is if the owner or the general told him. Now, if the owner and the general aren't going to pay these subcontractors, they're not going to go out and start raising cane and kicking sleeping dogs.
Well, but the difference is Diamond Shamrock doesn't need to know who the subcontractor is. It just needs to know that there are subcontractors. And you can walk out there and see them.
That's true, Your Honor. He could see that there was, we can't deny that they could see, because it's just flat land out there, they could see the construction going on 7.1 acres. But take this hypothetical, Your Honor, using Mr. Valdez's argument is. Let's assume that on day one, Diamond Shamrock went out and said, Mr. Valdez, have you been paid? Mr. Valdez says, yes, I've been paid. Now, up there's today's date. Day two, Diamond Shamrock completes its purchase of the property. Day three, Mr. Valdez does some more work on the 7.1 acres. He's not paid. He files his land. Under Mr. Valdez's theory, his land relates back to the date the work started, not day one when Diamond Shamrock asked him, but way back up here in February of 1986. So even if Diamond Shamrock had asked him, his land is still going to prime Diamond Shamrock under his theory. The fact that 056, the pre-land notice, is not really applicable to this situation because there were no improvements on Diamond Shamrock's property makes it all the more important that the second type of notice have been given to Diamond Shamrock. And that is the post-land notice provided by Section 53.055. And with this notice, the subcontractor, or for that matter a contractor filing a lien under the mechanics lien statutes, must send a copy of the affidavit to the quote owner, end quote. The purpose of this notice is to put the owner on notice that his property is being subjected to a lien. Now, admittedly, the statutes do not now and have never defined an owner. Case law really doesn't define an owner. With respect to mechanics liens, I'm going to cite the court some cases in a moment on other statutes. But as the owner is not defined, and as we've got two different purposes for notice here, there's nothing, either in case law or the statutes, that says the owner must be the same. You can have one owner for pre-lien notice and a second owner for the post-lien notice. If you look at cases where owner has been used in statutes similar to the mechanics lien statutes, and by similar I mean that someone is trying to take a piece of property, you'll come up with Houston North Shore Railway versus Tyrell, a Texas Supreme Court case, 1936, 98 Southwest 2nd, 786. That case involved condemnation, and the condemnation statute used the term, quote, owner, end quote. The Texas Supreme Court said that the owner refers to not only the holder of the fee simple title, but any other person with an interest in the property that will be affected by the condemnation. 2 years later, in 1938, in the case of Realty Trust Company versus Craddock, 112 Southwest 2nd, 440, the Texas Supreme Court again considered another case involving owner used in statute, and this was a paving lien assessment case, and the assessment statute used the term owner. And the Texas Supreme Court said that owner means substantially the same as applied to the word in matters of conveyance. In other words, the term quote owner, end quote, refers to a holder of record legal title. The principle of these cases is that when a statute refers to owner, and someone is trying to take an interest in that property, the owner that is referred to is the owner at the time the notice is given, an owner who has a present possessory interest in the property. This was explained by the Texas Supreme Court again a little bit differently in the case of Berry v. McAdams, 55 Southwest 1112. That was a mechanics lien case. And in that case, the court says the mechanics lien statutes give the lien claimant the opportunity to have a lien, but the claimant must have due regard for the rights of the owner by giving notice. And the purpose of this notice is to prevent claims based upon allegations of actual knowledge or constructive notice, which are oftentimes impossible for an owner to refute. But written notice, on the other hand, is definite and certain information upon which the owner must take action. The purpose behind the mechanics lien statute is to get the mechanics lien payment, the mechanics lien claimant paid for work he has done on the property. How can that purpose be furthered if the person to receive notice is someone other than the present possessory interest holder of a piece of property? Why would someone care what happens to this property if they don't currently own. I think the answer is pretty obvious, especially in this case. They don't care, particularly if they're judgment-proof. What difference does it make to them? They haven't paid their contractors. What do they care what happens to this property? Maybe someone's going to leave them with a burden.
Yeah, so let me ask you a question. If the court were to accept your view,
yes, sir,
a hypothetical, would it not lead to a situation where owners like Opus could replat after the lien has attached, smaller tracts, and cut off the subcontract?
No, sir, it does not, Your Honor. For over 100 years, I'm not trying to dodge your question, but I want to expand on it so I can give you a complete answer, Your Honor. For over 100 years, Texas case law has construed mechanics lien statutes. And these statutes have used virtually the same wording that the statutes they use. That is, they reference lots, particularly for a city, town, or village. To answer your question, no, Your Honor, that will not happen because the historic reach of a lien is to the improvement and the property necessarily connected therewith. That is the reach under the statutes. That is the reach under case law, starting with the case of Lyon v. Logan and coming right down to the present date. In this case, Mr.
But it looks as if the legislature has simplified that for city purposes and just said to the lot.
Your Honor, I don't believe in that case, in reference to that particular subsection of 5.3.022, that the legislature really means a platted lot. If they did, I don't think the legislature had in mind a platted lot of 100 acres or 10 acres. I think the legislature had in mind a platted lot that we generally think of, a residential lot or a normal city lot, where you have one improvement on that lot, which takes up the entire lot. The reason I say that is because Section 5.3.022 must be read in harmony. And petitioner is taking subparagraph C out of that and reading it in isolation. Subparagraph A is an overbroad reading of the statute. It says a lien under this statute applies to the improvement, which is what the Constitution says. The Constitution doesn't apply a lien to land, only to the improvement, and to the lots necessarily connected therewith. Subparagraph D concerns a lien in the country, and it says that a lien does not extend to more than 50 acres. No more than 50 acres. It is incongruous that if someone has a tract of land in a city, town, or village of 100 acres, and Mr. Valdez builds a small shed up here on the northwest corner that serves only that northwest corner, in a city, town, or village, he can get a lien under his theory on that whole 100 acres, but you move this tract outside the city, town, or village, and he can't. His lien is limited to that small corner. So I don't think that the word lot means a platted lot. What does it mean? It means that the lien extends to the improvement and to the property necessarily connected therewith.
Why didn't they just say that?
Your Honor, it beats me. I wish I had an answer, and I think that's something that maybe the legislature needs to address. But I don't, I can't conceive of the legislature meaning, I think the one answer may be that they use the term lot in a generic sense. For example, there are two cases that deal with property on city lots, the Hewitt case and the Bryant Link case that we cite in our brief. Both of those cases deal with lots in city, town, or village, one in Dallas, one in the village of Calvary. And in both instances, the court says that you've got to look at the improvement and you've got to look at how that improvement relates to the property because the lien only goes to the improvement and the property necessarily connected therewith. And in both those cases, we're talking about statutes that have the same or similar wording. The same or similar wording has been in just about the historic reach of the mechanics lien statute, Your Honor, where they've referred to lot. I wish I had an explanation to the court when they do use lot, but I don't think it's, as petitioner claims, a blanket mechanical rote reading of that word to mean a platted piece of property, no matter how big the property may be. As another example, look, while we're on lot, Your Honors, I can't believe that the legislature intended for a line drawn on some piece of paper to really control. Consider this case and just change one fact. One fact, before February of 1986, the platting process had been completed. In that case, I don't think there's any question that we wouldn't be here today, because even under petitioner's theory, his land would not extend, because they're two separate pieces of property. And that's all because of a piece of a line drawn on some paper that's not on the ground. It doesn't trip Mr. Valdez when he walks across that piece of property. So I don't think that a platted piece of property really matters. It's how the property is treated and the historic reach of a land.
If you were sitting in our court and you had the power and authority to write an opinion, how would you define lot?
I would define lot as being a generic term that does not mean a platted lot. Instead, it refers to the improvement and the land necessarily connected therewith, the curtilage, if you will, which goes with that improvement. That is the way cases have described the reach of a land under statutory lands and constitutional lands for over 100 years, Your Honor. I had a thought and it just escaped me, which was bumming me out here. Your Honor, if Mr. Valdez's theory becomes the law, it's not all roses, as petitioner and amicus would have you believe, because the fact situation that we have in this case is not at all unusual, where a developer will buy a big piece of property and develop part of it and reserve part of it to sell.
Does anybody have a question? I do. What was the rest of your sentence?
where a developer develops a piece of property and reserves a part of it to sell to someone else. If Mr. Valdez's theory becomes the law of the state and supplants 100 years of case law, development in that context will cease until the platting process is totally complete. And that may be months, it may be years, it may not happen until that developer finds a purchaser for this separate tract so he can adequately define it. In other words, Mr. Valdez, who depends on construction, may, by his own argument, be cutting off his own nose to spite his face.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. First off, the ruling we're asking for is not going to cause a major problem in development. It simply means that if some developer has a 100-acre tract and he induces a laborer to come out and put $1 million worth of paving and roadways, that laborer has the right to try and figure out the value of all that land and to figure he's got collateralization for his work until some subsequent arrangement by way of partial releases or whatever pays him off. It should not place him in the position of committing his work and sitting by month after month as tracts are carved out for later litigation to determine which tracts were necessarily connected and which weren't.
What specifically could Diamond Shamrock have done to protect itself in this instance? What should they have done?
Number one, they should have demanded lien releases from every contractor and subcontractor that was on the project as it existed right then.
The entire tract?
On the 7.9 acres, that's right. I would have made it a condition of closing to have a release from somebody like Juan Valdez, and if after that he's gone off and done more work on the 7.1 acres as counsel referred to, he wouldn't have had a claim against Diamond Shamrock and couldn't have claimed any deceit.
Didn't they receive a general warranty deed?
Yes.
Didn't they also receive a title policy?
Yes.
Did the title policy disclose any of the things that you referred to?
I don't think it did. I think the title company made a mistake, frankly.
So Diamond Shamrock should have looked beyond the record, the deed records that affected the tract it purchased to larger tracts from which this tract was subdivided.
Exactly. And if it had known, as I think the law imputes to them, Inman versus Clark, Woods versus Barnes, all the decisions that say there's this window out there, as a fallback, they should have said, we're going to withhold the purchase price for 90 days, and if our title company comes back and says there's a problem, we'll deal with it. That's the second way they could have completely protected themselves. Counsel said...
Here they could have waited 90 days and been none the wiser. They didn't get notice within 90 days. Didn't get notice for 3.5 years.
No, but after 90 days, the lien affidavit would have been a matter of public record, and if they'd
on the other track.
Well, it would have come up on all of it as far as title company purposes. Mr. Bracken said, well, what Mr. Valdez is supposed to do is, quote, rely on the owner or contractor to learn about the new owner. I don't think that's adequate protection. Mr. Valdez was getting stiffed for over 10% of his contract price, wound up having to sue these people, and for this court to say that the remedy for a subcontractor under the liberal protection of laborers and mechanicsmen is that he's got to trust the forthcoming honesty of people that he may well be adverse to protect his lien rights is not reasonable.
There in effect, aren't you saying that we really have two innocent parties here, one who relied on a general warranty deed and a title policy that disclosed no defects in title, and a subcontractor who performed his contract and simply didn't get paid? We have two innocent parties. In which way the court should fashion a policy as to who the loss should fall upon?
If you view as the facts show that this was a single undivided piece of property on which not a kiosk but a major commercial construction project was ongoing when these sophisticated real estate people got involved, I do not consider them innocent vis-a-vis Mr. Juan Valdez, who it's in the record, Your Honor, that the first lien deed of trust, or the construction loan, I should say, deed of trust, that financed all of Mr. Valdez's work, covered all of the 7.9 acres. You can deduce from the fact that Mr. Valdez was paid 90% of his contract that he was making draw requests. Aren't there lien releases that are normally required for every draw request every subcontractor ever gets? Those lien releases covered 7.9 acres. The harm and the deceit is to Mr. Valdez. He believed, and reasonably, he had a 7.9-acre lien, and it's simply because Diamond Shamrock and Opus One platted, he said it was in fall of 85. That's not true. It was platted in May of 86 when Valdez was almost finished. The deed was conveyed in July of 86 when Valdez was finished.
He said negotiations began prior to fall.
He did, but he also said, quote, this was all done in the fall of 85, and I thought he was referring to it.
If this was so open and obvious, why were none of these things disclosed on the title report that was received by Diamond Shamrock?
I absolutely think it should have been. Why the title company doesn't have ultimate liability here is beyond me, but I can't sue the title company. I've got to sue them, and they can take it up with the title company.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right, please rise.